Omaha Public Radio presents a lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Jonathan Edelman, a professor at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver, and author of The Rise of Israel, A History of a Revolutionary State. Dr. Edelman's remarks were given as the 2017 Ruth and Phil Sokoloff Lecture, co-sponsored annually by the Hannah and Natan Schwalb Center for Israel and Jewish Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, and the Jewish Federation of Omaha. He'll speak on the topic, Russia and Israel, New Emerging Powers in the Middle East. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, April 27, 2017, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the University of Nebraska at Omaha, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Gary Javich, speaking for the Sokoloff family.
Our guest presenter tonight is Dr. Jonathan Edelman. He's a wonderful speaker, I know from many times hearing him, who fits the criteria that we established for this series. He is at once interesting and influential, prominent and preeminent, as you'll find out. He joins the distinguished cast of past speakers that included ambassadors, best-selling authors, and star academics. As you know, the primary goal of this series is to expand knowledge about Judaism and Israel. Two recent events highlight the importance of that goal. Mayor Stothert signed a proclamation on Monday declaring April 23rd to the 30th as Holocaust Remembrance Week in Omaha. The other was the passing of Shirley Goldstein. Shirley worked to help better the lives of Jews trapped in the former Soviet Union, risking arrest in this Iron Curtain country to smuggle in Levi jeans and other valuable items. Jews were prevented from holding certain jobs and from leaving the country during that time period, 70s, 80s, part of the 90s. She also worked to get legislation passed that forced open the iron doors that permitted many Russians to reach, among many other countries, the United States and Israel. In fact, as I look around the room, I see at least one of the immigrants who credit Shirley with helping their family escape Russia, and they're here in the room tonight. And in addition, a 2007 visitor to Omaha, the renowned Natan Sharansky, now a resident of Israel, where he heads the Jewish Agency and became an internationally known best-selling author. He also credited Shirley with doing things to help him get released. Israel represents a safe haven for Jews facing anti-Semitism. And to connect the two events, remembering the Holocaust and Shirley's efforts to help Russians reach Israel, the ancient and now present homeland, I wanted to bring that note in before I started the other paragraph. Israel represents a safe haven still today for Jews facing anti-Semitism, especially in Europe, but other places around the world and even in the United States. But it's that murderous anti-Semitism that we see in the headlines day after day or frequently in Europe. Israel, in contrast to many other countries in the Middle East, is a beacon in the world. And that's one of the principal reasons why the Schwalb Center means so much to me as an opportunity to become better informed about Israel and Judaism. Israel is brought to the world many scientific and medical advances with their inventions making the world a much better place. In particular, think cell phones, think computers, significant components of which were invented and are produced in Israel. But tonight, under the auspices of UNO, the Natan and Hannah Schwalb Center and the Jewish Federation of Omaha, please give a warm welcome to Alan Potash, the CEO of the Jewish Federation, who is going to introduce our guest.
Thank you, Gary. You did a pretty good job of introducing the speaker, so I'll say a few other things. I want to just really thank UNO, the Sokolov family, for allowing the Jewish Federation of Omaha to be part of this wonderful speakers series. This past fall, Moshe called me and he said, Alan, I want to run a few names by you about speakers for the Sokolov evening. And he went through name after name after name. He said, I have one more I want to share with you. His name is Professor Jonathan Edelman from Denver University. And I said, is that the Professor Edelman who was Condoleezza Rice's dissertation advisor? He said, yes. He said, is this Jonathan Edelman, the professor who's an expert on the Middle East, Russia, and China? And he said, yes. I said, okay, I think he'd be a good speaker for this evening. My only question, Moshe, is do you think China and Russia and the Middle East will be interesting in the spring of 2017? Well, I think he was right. He had a vision for the future. Professor Edelman's bio was pretty extensive. I want to just highlight a few things before he comes up and really gives his talk this evening. When I was going through his bio, there was one thing that stood out to me amongst the other things, and that was in 2004, he was a lecturer with the Jacob and Hannah Baumer Lecture at Columbia University. Previous lecturers were Elie Wiesel, Isaac Bashevis Singer, and William Sapphire, three phenomenal individuals who I've followed most of my life. So if he followed them, he's going to follow and bring us tonight some insight into what's going on in the world. He's an expert on China, the Middle East, and Russia. He has lectured in 17 different opportunities in China on behalf of the State Department. He's lectured all over the world, 15 international speaking tours into 13 different countries. So without further ado, I welcome Professor Edelman to Omaha, Nebraska, and you are in for a great evening. Thank you.
Well, it's great to be back here again. I've been trying to figure it out. I think this is the fourth time, but we shall see. But when we think about our topic for this evening, about the emergence of Russia and Israel in the Middle East, we need to ask ourselves a big question. Why should we even care about this or any other subject matter for that? And why did it seem so amazing that this would even occur? If we think about both Russia and Israel today and their role in the Middle East, what's powerful is the fact that both have emerged recently, not only separately, but in their interactions. Bibi Netanyahu has been to Russia, to Moscow and Crimea five times in the last 20 months, talks on the phone almost every week, from what we understand, to the Russians. And when you think about it, it sounds so absurd. After all, the majority of American Jews, including my family, came from Tsarist Russia, came from Latvia in that case, and from Odessa. And the one thing that would have stunned my grandparents to learn is that the Israelis and Russians are not only talking to each other, they're even collaborating with each other. How can that possibly be? And secondly, how can Russia amount to anything? We saw in 1991 a spectacular destruction of the Soviet Union. But it didn't occur through armies from other countries. It occurred because it collapsed from within. And the peoples in the 14 republics that became independent, also because they'd had enough of the Russians and their rule. But if you think that that is not even 26 years ago, that it's very recent, and think about how weak Russia is today. When you listen to people talk about Russia, they often have the image of the Soviet Union. But the Russians lost 50% of all their population. They fell from 300 million people to 150 million. And today, because they keep losing population every year, they're down to around 142 million people. If you talk about economy, we have a lot of concerns in the United States, justifiably so, that in the last 8 to 10 years, we have seen the American economy grow very slowly at about 2% a year. And even though it doesn't sound like much, 3 or 4% would make a huge difference for many people. But the American economy, despite all its current problems, has something very powerful. The GNP per capita in the United States is $58,000. The overall sum of the GNP is $18 trillion. When you compare Russia to it, it seems almost absurd that we're here talking about it. The United States has $18 trillion economy, and what is the economy of Russia? It's $1.5 trillion. The United States has an economy that is 12 times the size of Russia, and even if you factor in the difference in population, the United States has $57,000 GNP per capita, and Russia, depending on what's happening with the ruble, is somewhere around 7,000 to 9,000 or 10,000. When we think about allies in the world today, despite our best efforts, we still have many friends around the world. We do a good job of alienating people recently. But what's powerful is that we have as our allies the NATO countries. And even Donald Trump recently brought them back, from oblivion to being our allies. And we're thinking about England, we're thinking about France, we're thinking about Germany. And when you look at the EU altogether, its overall GNP is another $16 to $18 trillion. You think about our position in Asia, and you look at the fact that the United States has excellent relations with the Japanese, with the Taiwanese, with, of all countries, Vietnam. They even let us use their docks for our ships, even military these days. So people forget what happened 40 years ago. And when we ask, what about the most important aspect economically of a country today? And, of course, the world has changed. Back in the early 19th century, that was railroads, which just came in because of the invention of George Stephenson in 1806. And by the 1830s, the European powers had tens of thousands of miles of railroad and dramatically changed the world. Today, that change factor is called Silicon Valley. That is a very powerful one. And when we ask ourselves, who is in the lead? The United States has about 70% of the major companies in Silicon Valley, hiring many of them up to 50% foreigners. And the Russians? I can tell you a quick story. One time I was at CSHA, was the Institute of USA and Canada Relations. I'm sure the Canadians were thrilled to be in with the Americans. And what was fascinating was when I was done giving a talk, they said, okay, that kind of way Russians love to talk. Oh, okay, so you can ask one question, okay, because you're in the foreign ministry. You can get one question that we will actually answer truthfully. So I thought of, this is Russia, let's get real. So I knew how to get it. So I asked them, look, you have some of the best scientists, technicians, and engineers in the world, almost a million of them. When they go abroad, like they go to Israel, they're 50%, those million Russian Jews that went there, 50% of Silicon Wadi in Israel. And you go ask about, in the United States, there's about 10,000 Russians in senior positions in high technology. So you've got some of the best. Nobody's denying that. But how come you have nothing here except in the suburbs of Moscow, and that has exactly one building? So I waited for the answer, and we got a great Russian answer. They drew themselves up very appropriately, in case anybody was looking, and said, we want to tell you this. The reason we don't have Silicon Valley here is very simple. We are waiting for the state to create it. So much for capitalism. And when you spend time on your first couple of times in Russia, you're absolutely stunned, not by what they have, but what they don't have. You wonder, get outside of Moscow, go 20, 30, 40 miles, and you see a country that does not and has never undergone an agricultural revolution. A country like in Moscow, where 60% of all the food is brought in from abroad. A place where there are still peasants. What do you see when you get out into the countryside? What you see is women in black putting little seeds in holes in the ground. You see, 20% of the food is stolen, according to Russian statistics, before it ever reaches where it's supposed to go, to the major cities. So when you look at Russia, and you also say, where is their consumer goods? Have you ever gone into a department store? Okay, I'll admit it. My mother didn't have a daughter, so I became the one who went shopping. And I love shopping. I have to explain that to some people, but I love to shop. And so if you go to stores and you turn over the label, have you ever found it say, made in Russia, made in Moscow, made in St. Petersburg? Never. So here's a country that in some respects has missed the 19th and 20th century in terms of lack of an agricultural revolution, lack of a consumer revolution, and a country that a recent survey that just came out in time for me to give this to you, that 25% of all Russians, that means out of about 35 million of them, want to leave the country. One out of every four Russians, together with the 11 million who've left in the last 25 years. So we could go on and on, but we won't. You'll be saved. But you get the point. Russia, of all the countries, if you didn't know what country it was, you would say a country that with all of these negatives can't even produce Silicon Valley when they've got the right people, a country that doesn't have the agricultural side, it doesn't have the consumer side, and it's managed to alienate a number of other countries. How could that be a significant actor in the Middle East, especially a country that has a lower GNP than England, France, or Germany, not together, but each of them individually? And then you turn to Israel. And if you think about Israeli history, we won't go into it in any great length, but just think about this. When the first Zionist Congress was held in 1897, okay, in Switzerland, in Basel, Switzerland, how many Jews were there at that time in what would become Israel? Tell me, what do you think?
10,000.
A little higher, 40,000 to 50,000. You could put them into a football stadium, and that was it. And most of them were religious, and they had come to what became Israel, not to live, but to die in Israel. And they lived hard lives at that particular time, 40,000. And you'd say, a country with 40,000 people, or even when you get to the end of the 1930s and or right after World War II, when it goes to 400,000. This is a country when the Arab states that surround it have 35 times more people, so that even if they're not very good militarily, they're just going to win by numbers. And you look at 1948, 650,000 finally are there. But most of them had no military skill. Many of them had fled the Holocaust. And the only ones who had any real military capability were the 33,000 that served in the British Army, and most of them had not actually been seriously in combat. So when you think about that, and somebody were to tell you in 1948, give them 70 years, 60 or 70 years, they're going to be a major power in the Middle East and even beginning to be a serious power around the world. You say, that's not possible. It's not going to happen. And yet, here we are today, in 2017. Both Russia and Israel have become major powers in the Middle East. And think what miracles have occurred. David Ben-Gurion once was asked, what's the most important thing? This was the 1950s when he was in power. He was asked, what is the most important thing that will make a difference for Israel? He said, it's something that is never going to happen. He said, there's the inner circle and there's the outer circle. And the inner circle is what's going to choke us to death. Even Yigal Yadin said during the 48 war, this best 50-50 chance we'll survive even against very weak Arab armies because almost no one had fought and they didn't have heavy mechanical capabilities and so forth. So he said the problem is the inner circle. The problem is Egypt. The problem is Jordan. The problem is Syria. They're the ones who threaten us by 20-1, 30-1 margins. And indeed, we had the 48 war, the 56 war, the 67 war, the 69 war, the 73 war, and the 81 war. And so from that viewpoint, it seemed absolutely impossible for Israel to really be able to survive. And when we look at the numbers, even today, how many countries have 8.5 million people and are considered a major power in any region around the world? certainly not in Asia, not in North America, where Americans have almost 330 million people, certainly not in Asia, where the Chinese have 1.35 billion people, the Indians have 1.1 billion people, and even smaller countries have 10 times more people than Israel. So when you look at it from any kind of historical or comparative point of view, it seems to be ridiculous to suggest even that they have come back or that they would come back. Nobody thought the Russians would make a comeback after 1991. Boris Yeltsin was convinced that you had to take a different road, but he did it so badly and so ineptly that Russians were delirious to find out that he finally were getting rid of him by the end of the 1990s. And they went with an unknown former KGB agent, Vladimir Putin, who had spent 6 years in East Germany. So if we ask ourselves, how did this ever happen, and what does it mean, and what about the relationship between the two? Because that's the final question you get in the beginning. And that is, how will the Jews, many of whom fled Soviet Union, fled Tsarist Russia, should come to Israel and to make up the majority of the Ashkenazi Jews who live in Israel today? How could it possibly be that they could create a modern country? And they had very little background in able to do that. Kibbutz, Moshav, Histadrut, the Labor Party in the 20s, 30s, and 40s suggested no, that that was going to be very unlikely. It might survive, but it wasn't going to be major. And with regards to Russia, the level of anti-Semitism has been quite high, as witnessed the millions of Russian Jews who have moved to the United States or moved to Israel. And if you ask yourselves, before Vladimir Putin, who was the only Russian leader in the 20th century that was pro-Semitic? And you know the answer? Lenin. Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov, who had, they finally confirmed this after about 70 years, a Jewish grandfather. And the reason nobody knew it was that he had converted. He was one of the 40,000 that actually converted to Russian Orthodoxy. But Lenin himself said something very famous in his short reign until January of 1924. But Lenin himself said, what is powerful, he said, is that we look out and we ask ourselves, where do we find the people who will support the Bolshevik Revolution? There's only one people. Those are Jews. And he said something that was amazing. He said, scratch an old Bolshevik, and you'll always find some Jewish blood. He wasn't being negative. He was being very positive at that time. And so what's powerful is, in a country with strong anti-Semitism, where the majority of the population, certainly rural and smaller towns and parts of the metropolitan centers, less but still some, is still one of the leaders, that we have a leader of Russia today who is not anti-Semitic for the first time in 93 years. And his story, as you know, I think most people know the story, but a few people don't. Why is Vladimir Putin pro-Semitic? Pro-Semitic is clear. There's a Jewish museum for $40 million in Moscow. The Israelis were asked to help in Skolkovo in the suburbs of Moscow to work on a second Silicon Valley for the Russians, but the Russians haven't been able to do much. But it's talking every week with the Prime Minister of Israel, welcoming him to Moscow. And the answer is very simple. And the answer is, it was his childhood. We know that when you find a person who doesn't have any known physical capabilities and they spend their life trying to convince the majority of the population that they fight tiger lions, that they fly supersonic jet fighters, that they can run with the tanks and all that, this was a troubled person. And it turned out that in 2005, we finally got the answer to this question about Vladimir Putin. Why is he at least mildly pro-Semitic? And he's even called for Europe. Did you catch that a couple of weeks ago? He called on European Jews to move back to Russia. You cannot imagine the Tsar doing that. You can't imagine Joseph Stalin wanting to do that, or Leonid Brezhnev. But the reason is very simple. When he was in Israel in 2005, he went out and bought an apartment, as some of you know, in Tel Aviv. Not for himself, but for this Russian Jewish teacher, evidently religious, who lived on the same block as he grew up in St. Petersburg. And when you think of a boy who at age 12 goes to the Russian security services and say, I'm ready, take me, I don't want to go to school anymore, you know you have some serious issues. And this was this Jewish woman who took him in. And that's who he bought the apartment for. And then it was revealed for the first time, well, he is the only Russian leader in almost 100 years to be positive about the Jews and about Israel. Not totally. He's still on the side of the Iranians. But they talk and they interact a great deal so that Israeli and Russian pilots will not attack each other in Syria. And you may remember an incident that happened back in the war over the Gulf in 1969. And at that time, the Russian fighter jets did decide to take on the Israeli military. We're not sure how deliberate it was, but it was pretty serious. And they went after Israeli jet fighters. 45 seconds later, five Russian planes had been shot down. No Israelis. The Russian military suggested they skip fighting the Israelis the next time that might come up, which has now come up in Syria. We don't want this to happen again. It was very, very embarrassing for a superpower to have a third-rate power shoot down their airplanes. So what we ask then is the obvious questions. And the obvious questions are, first, how can these countries get along? Because up to a certain point, they're not perfect allies at all. They disagree sharply over Iran. But I would argue that even that's going to change. Because if you go back 4 years, when the Russians canceled, remember the S-300 anti-missile system, what was really fascinating at that time, which almost nobody did in the United States, to my knowledge, is read what the Iranians said about that and what the Russians wrote in their own newspaper. The Iranians said that this shows how disgusting the Russians are, and how can they possibly not give us the S-300? We warrant it. If you want to be a superpower, you've got to act like one. And what did Moscow write? Officially on the front page of the newspaper, they said, we would like to remind our Iranian comrades, jokingly, of course, we'd like to remind our Iranian comrades of the last 200 years of the history of Russia and Iran. Now, of course, 99% of the American people know the answer to that question, but what's powerful is that Russia had invaded Iran four times during that time and viewed the Iranian-Persian Empire, together with Ottoman-Turkish Empire, as blocking the capacity of Russia to get into the Mediterranean and into the Middle East. And so what's powerful is we know that the Russians have no love lost for Iran. But most importantly, and this isn't going to change in the short run, because they want to win first, that's for sure. But they have now become a major factor in the Middle East, not just in Syria. If you were in Jordan, what more pro-American, you know, leader can you possibly have than King Abdullah II? We only wish that all of them were like that, right? And he also went to military academy in England. He spoke English so well that when he was suddenly his father, King Hussein, you may remember, switched and gave him the power to succeed, not his brother, that his brother, King Abdullah II, was so lacking knowledge of Arabic, he couldn't speak well in classical Arabic, which a ruler speaks. That's how westernized he was. Then again, of course, we all realize that Bashar al-Assad was an ophthalmologist in London, so don't carry this too far. But what was powerful, therefore, is that the Russians want to dominate as much as they can in the Middle East, but they recognize there are limits. And so they have been playing with King Abdullah II. Most people don't talk about this, to sell him two nuclear reactors. They have been negotiating with Saudi Arabia to sell them 30 to 32 nuclear reactors. They have been working together with the United Arab Emirates because now there is a possibility that has been opened up by the fact that there is something that people are deeply afraid of, and that's called Iran. And for the Sunni Arab states to face a Shiite state, which to their minds, the person that they hate, the Sunni Arab leaders, is Barack Obama, because they blame him for not being, and I'm not saying this in a partisan way. What I'm saying is, what do they think? And they argue that the United States has a powerful interest, as do they, in arming the Sunni Arab states and making it clear to Iran that they don't get nuclear weapons, that they don't continue the kind of war that we see in Syria, in Libya, in Yemen, in Iraq, and so forth. So in the short run, no. But in the longer run, particularly assuming that the Russians continue to do quite well in this chaos, and their boy has won. I mean, Bashar al-Assad has won. And here's one of the things that bring Israelis and Russians together. Israelis don't want to talk about it in public, but in quiet, not much, but in quiet, they've made it clear, we prefer Bashar Assad. Not because of the horrible things he's done. I mean, God save us. You know, he's killed 450,000 civilians. He's used chemical weapons. You know, this is all dreadful. But let me ask you, why would they prefer, why would the Israelis prefer that Bashar Assad wins? And what are the answers? One thing is ISIS, but there's something more here that's important. Okay, Chechnya. They are afraid of how far they can go, and the Iranians are making tremendous progress in kind of religious, ideological grounds with all of the Shiites, even in a westernized state like Lebanon. Even there, they're doing very well. So the Russians understand there's a limit to how far we can go, given the amount of money, given how little money we have. I mean, not even 10% of the American economy. I mean, Americans are arguing over issues that to Russians are incomprehensible. Talking about $1 trillion, there would go most of the Russian GNP in one failed blow. No. So what they're saying is that the Israelis are saying, we want Bashar to win for several reasons. First, he will be under the control of the Russians. We get along well with the Russians. We're not worried. Secondly, the rest of the country is going to be divided up. And what other factions are going to be in there, right? You're going to have the Kurds, and you're going to have the rebels that are pro-Western, and you're going to have some of the radicals who are going, radical Islamists. But from an Israeli military point of view, the moment that they still remember with deep fear is what happens in the first week of the Yom Kippur War in 1973. The Syrian army got within 2.5 miles of being inside Israel at the Benot Yaakov Bridge, and that scared the hell out of the Israelis, because if you face multiple countries and just the Syrians can do it, that was something very afraid. But now there is not going to be a Syria. There's going to be Syrians, 3, 4, 5, all divided up, each one under the power of a Russia or some other countries. So from an Israeli perspective, as much as they hate the civilian damage, and they're trying to be helpful, they've taken in 3,000 sick and wounded Syrians and treated them in Israeli hospitals, where they say amazing things, which would probably get them killed when they go back home, like, we love the Israelis, because they save their lives. That is one of the major factors that's important. But there's other things that bring them together. The second is culture. If you're Russian, where else are you going to go in the world where you hear Russian, it's the number three language, it's sometimes the number two language. And what's powerful here is that one time I was at the Russian foreign ministry, and I got to actually give a course there for a week. It was very interesting. It was so different than the State Department, but I don't want to say bad words about either side, but it was very, very, very different. But what was fascinating about it was that at the foreign ministry was the notion that was powerful here was that I asked one of the Russian diplomats, I said to them, okay, that I come to know, I said, not like Admiral Flynn, but what I asked him was very simple. I said to him, where in the world would you like to be posted? Since you've had a high position in the foreign ministry, you can probably go to just about any country around the world. And, of course, he said, I want to go to the United States. I said, and what's the number two country in the world you want to go to? He wasn't Jewish or anything. He said, the only country that's worth going to is Israel. I said, why? I wanted to hear his reasoning. He said, because where else do I feel comfortable? I hear Russian everywhere I go. The country was founded by Russians. Okay, they were Jews, so we got to overlook that fact. But if you forget about that, think about it. David Ben-Gurion's from Russian Plansk. Chaim Weizmann is from Pinsk. Golda Meir was from outside of Kiev. And you can go down the list. One study showed 65% of the leaders of Israel came from Russia. He said, I feel at home there. It's a great place for me. So this is an important factor for the Russians because they look around the world, and what do they see? They don't see those kind of concentrations and those people in power. Look at the defense minister. Who's the defense minister of Israel? Avigdor Lieberman, who comes from Russia. Where else would you get a first-generation Russian immigrant in a position as powerful and as important? He, the Russians would say, that's somebody we can talk to. Yeah, he's a tough guy, but we are tough too, so we can understand each other. So it is language, it is culture, it is the way Israel was founded. It was founded heavily by Russian Jews. But the great majority of the Sephardim came later in the 1950s. Of the 900,000 Sephardi Jews who fled in the 1950s, 600,000 of them went to Israel, where they now make up about a little over 50% of the Jewish population because they have a higher birth rate. And 300,000 went to France and other countries like that. So it's the very concept. Think about it. Where did the Israeli Labor Party get the notion of kibbutz, moshav, right, and Labor Party? They got it because they got it from Russian socialist ideology. They cooled it down some. But think about what they did. It was radical in the day, starting in the 1880s, and certainly by the time you get to second and third Aliyah. First, not much, but second and third. They came from Russia. They came with the notions that we need to perfect the world, and everybody, like in a kibbutz, should make exactly the same amount of money. Lenin would have been proud of this. And so think about it. Socialism and communism failed in Russia, but it was quite successful in Israel because of a very different condition. So for Russians, this is something they can perfectly understand. We can look at the trade unions, great. Check that off. We can look at Moshav and Kibbutz, tick that off. And not only that, but many of those people, like, you know, Moshe Dayan and others, were in power in that country. But beyond that, there's something else. There's a greater threat out there as far as the Russians are concerned. They have respect for the Israeli military because of what the Israeli military did to them. And also because of Shin Bet. That's important. The Russians have possibly the best, if not the second best, intelligence apparatus. We're having a big argument over how far they went. But we just saw that they penetrated the German defense ministry. I mean, they're very good at what they do because they have 90% of those people. Now it's 900,000 because about 100,000 scientists, technicians, and engineers left, mainly for Israel and the United States. But now those people that remain go to work for the military and the secret police. That's not true in the United States. 10%, 20%, probably not even the best. But in Russia, the best go there because you get special privileges and you can avoid a lot of other problems with the state if you're serving the state in that way. So from a Russian perspective, Israel seems familiar, if they only weren't Jews. But apart from that, you know, they'll have to overlook that. But apart from that, the socialism, the capabilities and technology which Russians do have for the military, very close to the level of the United States. Go back to the 1950s. Remember? Who first went out into space? It wasn't the Americans. It was the Russians. Who developed some of the first atomic bombs? You know, and the Russians first had spies. Okay, they had German spies in the Manhattan Project during World War II. But afterwards, that didn't do you much good when now you're a lot past the Manhattan Project. And the father of the hydrogen bomb in Russia was a Russian Jew. And if you go and look at Katyusha rockets, a study showed 7 out of 8 people that created that for the Russians were Jews. And so they're used to this. You may not love it, but if we have to, it's better to deal with them than the Arabs, who are hopeless. So what we have, so we can kind of get to some Q&A, what we have that's fascinating is that these two countries that seemed so improbable, Israel in 1897, completely hopeless, Israel in 1948, nearly lost the war, came very close in the first few months to losing the war. You remember the battle for Jerusalem and so forth. And Now they have both become major powers in the Middle East. That's the final point, and it's important. It's important because this is the first time that what David Ben-Gurion said 70 years ago is coming to be. So, by the way, he was also wrong on the flip side. He said it's the outer circle that will save us. And who is the outer circle? Anybody know? Turkey, Iran, and God knows why, Ethiopia. So don't ask. I don't know. He was probably trying to be, you know, non-racist or something. But what's powerful, therefore, is that the Russians and the Israelis have major differences, no question about it, and still major differences in size and so forth. But as far as the Russians are concerned, one thing that is different between the communist and the fascist, there's a number of things. Sometimes people say, well, they're the same thing. There's actually some major differences. One of the differences is the communists have generally known when to stop. Imagine if Adolf Hitler, after he defeated France in June of 1950, said, okay, guys, we're done. It would have been all over for the United States. The United States still was isolationist. The United States had 300,000 soldiers. German army had 3-4 million soldiers, better soldiers. My father was in World War II. He said that when he was a very unlikely candidate as a biologist to get involved with the war, but he got, he got taken, shall we say, in 1943. And he said the thing that amazed him, even as a total amateur, was how unprepared the American military was. He said it was so unprepared because you have to remember that in America today there's 58 million Germans. If you don't think so, try going to Minneapolis. Try going to Cincinnati. They're in the and they even taught before World War I in Minneapolis in German in the public schools. The number one immigrant group to America is not the English. That's 33 million. It's the Germans. And he said what was stunning to him, just being Jewish and very involved with that and a future Israel, what was stunning to him was that the German-American soldiers all said the same thing. They said, we're Germans. They're Germans. Forget the rest of this. Why are we going to fight our brothers and sisters? You know what the American government had to do? They don't want to talk about this because it was embarrassing, beyond embarrassing. But they brought in commissars. Borrowed it from the Russians. They brought in people who had to patiently explain that you are now an American of German origin. You're not a German-American. And therefore, it is your duty and obligation to fight. And he said they still didn't do real great because they didn't even know who Adolf Hitler was. Back then, they didn't have television. They had radio and not a lot. And they just thought he was some nationalist right-wing leader. They had no idea about the rest. So what's powerful here is that for Israel, it's a country that the Russians can understand. It's a country that they want to deal with because there's almost, I'm trying to think of other countries in the world that have that much ideology, those kind of numbers, several million people, the way politics is done. And I won't go into detail, but even some of Israeli politics does begin to resemble Russian politics. It goes on and on and on forever. And so from the viewpoint of Israel, it wants the Russians up to the point. And the point has been made very clear by Bibi Netanyahu. We are happy to be friendly to Russia. We're happy to work with Russia. We're happy to even have museums and, you know, we're happy to even, you know, watch out and make sure that ISIS doesn't win. But Iran is the question mark. That's the one we can't answer since we're not inside the leadership of Russia. But I'll give you one other reason why it's possible that in the long run, not the short run, in the long run, Putin will probably come down against them for the same reason they had with the S-300 affair. Russia still sees itself as a great power. Vladimir Putin is trying to restore Russia as a superpower. He's not going to get there, but it is the number two power in the world right now. If it is, can you put up with Iran dominating the Middle East? Nothing to do with Israel, nothing to do with Jews, but it has to do with them. And the same issue about Turkey. Tayyip Erdogan has moved Turkey. It's so disgusting. From a semi-democratic, you know, country that was really beginning to develop for decades, followed what Kemal Atatürk wanted to do. And by the way, as some of you may have read, Kemal Atatürk himself went to a day school, a Jewish day school, as a child In Salonika. That's been documented. But it wasn't a usual one. I always forget his name. In 1660s, there was a member of this Jewish guy who proclaimed himself the Messiah. Say it again? Shabtai Tzvi. Right. And they've gone through the records, and Kemal Ataturk had to be Jewish. Because who else would go to such a school? I mean, you know, for people who believed in Shabtai Tzvi. And which also explains one thing. How come he was so virulently anti-Muslim, so virulently anti, you know, backward, and wanted to be modern and progressive and, you know, like everybody in this room wants. Now you get an idea why, where it came from. So what's powerful is we will see in the years to come whether how far the Russians are prepared to go. But now that they've won Syria, now that they have done Abkhazia and southern Ossetia, now that they have done Crimea, now that they have done parts of left bank Ukraine, now that they are the victors here, and they're working with the same people, the same countries that Israel is working on, they at some point are going to have to make a decision. And it's likely that given the fact that Vladimir Putin is not just a Russian nationalist, but Vladimir Putin is religious, don't ask. I don't know how that happened. But his Jewish teacher didn't do it right. He became Russian Orthodox. And the first thing he did was so repulsive to everybody in the Jewish community. You know what he did? He allowed the Russian Orthodox Church to make saints out of the Tsar and Tsarina, the last Tsar and Tsarina of Russia, who were virulent anti-Semites. They are now saints. The whole family was made saints. But this is the source of much of his power. His weakness is in Moscow and St. Petersburg. He has some support. But his real power is in the Nizhny Novgorods of the world, the Vladivostoks of the world, and in the more rural areas. And there, they want Russia to come back. So a few final words about Israel. For Israel, this is truly remarkable. We have seen Israel emerge from a country that when I first went there, after I graduated Columbia College, before I stayed on for graduate school, that what was powerful here was that in 1969, Israel was not a first world country. I wouldn't call it third world, I'd call it transitional, but there were still, I remember thinking, do I want to make Aliyah? I tried twice. It gives you a whole different vision of Israel when you get involved with the bureaucrats. But then again, so does it in the United States. But what was powerful was that you still saw a lot of Israel that looked like Eastern Europe, which is where the people had come from. Now when you go to Israel, you see a totally different Israel. Not that there's still not some serious problems, but you see a country where the price of real estate has gone even a million in East Jerusalem. I'm involved with a group. Actually, I'm already in two groups to buy something in Israel. And there's a third one out, and they're saying nothing in East Jerusalem can be bought for less than $1 million. It's a totally different world. But it's also become, and that's the conclusion, Israel has finally become a modern state. Look at Israel, if you want to believe that, look at not at the Jews, but look at Israeli Arabs, 1.7 million of them. A recent poll done by Palestinians in Ramallah asked them, how would you characterize your view of this state of Israel? And the result was stunning. 63% of Israeli Arabs said Israel is the best state that we can live in. Now, granted, compared to Syria, compared to Libya, compared to Iraq, but it says something. You go to Hadassah Medical Center, I strongly urge you to take the tours, because it's not the medicine that you see. It's you see Arab doctors, you see Arab nurses. In fact, when the person I was with had to have, we went to Shari Tzedek, and it was an Arab doctor, could barely speak English, and Arab nurses. One-third of all the people who go to Hadassah are Israeli Arabs. They have a life expectancy of 79 years, which is far greater than they would get elsewhere. The food is clean, and now the Israelis are finally opening up against the one thing that is bad, the job discrimination against Israeli Arabs, because they're starting to work with them in the Galilee with Israeli high technology. They're even working with them in Ramallah now. They say the only problem is it's hard to get together. But it leads the Palestinians in a different direction than saying, okay, there's only one possibility here. And when you look at the other institutions. Israel has become much more modern than it used to be. In terms of the military capability, 100 to 200 atomic bombs, built, by the way, with whose help? Not Germany. Excellent. France. And when? Exactly. From 1956 to 1967. And then Charles de Gaulle came in. And they did it in a very fascinating way. The French wanted to hide. You know, this was the time they were losing their colonial powers. They lost Vietnam and they in 1954, and they were about to lose, they lost Algeria in 1958. So they didn't send just any French scientist. You know what they did? It's just amazing what countries come up with. They took the French Jews who were scientists so they could say they just wanted to go visit the homeland. The non-Jews were invited. Of course, from the viewpoint of, you know, Shin Bet and Mossad, this was a good alternative. So they're the ones who actually really helped the Israelis to build the atomic bomb. So when you look at their military capability, which is rated in the top, there's a recent article that looked called Israel as one of the top 10 military powers in the world. It's number 8 right now and moving up. When you look at high technology, just like the sale that you just saw, where Intel paid $15.2 billion to a company called, we're talking about the self-driving cars. Mobilize. $15 billion. And they announced something very important. Now Intel originally, one of the main people who created it was a Hungarian Jew, and their family had survived. And he came to the United States, but he didn't forget where he came from. There are almost 10,000 Israelis working for Intel in Israel, which has paid off in spades for them. This is also going to be in Israel, which is going to make Israel the center of where cars are going in the next 20, 30 years. And when you look at the educational level, 40% of Israelis go to, and most finish college. There is no, what nice words can I use here? Let's just say that standards are maintained, okay, in this case. And when you look at one final thing that, and this is important for Israelis, is they are willing to do things with other countries that most people wouldn't do. When I was in China, I've been there almost 20 times, so it's a totally different zone. But what was fascinating was listening to them talk about the Russians versus the Israelis. And saying, when the Israelis come, they come to our remote capitals, and then they go 12 hours into the darkness where there is no water, where the air is impure, and they stay there and camp out for a couple of weeks and work on developing the water. Now you know why the Indians want them to come and help them too. So they have those capabilities. They're limited by their size, and they're limited by one last thing, by the fact there are two groups in Israel. The Hasidim on one side, 900,000 of them, and on the other side, who? And the Israeli Arabs, who are getting much better education. After 1948, 156,000 Arabs remained in Israel. We won't get into the argument about what happened to the others. No, the general consensus is that some of what happened was forced, and most of it was voluntary. So they're saying about 75% went peacefully, and there was a war going on, and another 20% were told, you've got to move. But what's powerful is that Israel has capabilities that are remarkable because they are willing to go everywhere. I saw my son yesterday. He now works in Shanghai. He works for a Chinese company. He's American, but he got hired by the Chinese, and there got $2 billion in venture capital, and they want to buy companies that are worth between $80 and $150 million. And they said, this is in Shanghai, we'll buy, and I had David ask them, you willing to buy Israeli companies? He said, we'd love to. They're very good, and the best thing about them is they're as good as American companies. This is from a Chinese source. They're as good as American, but they're 30% cheaper. So therefore, you ought to go do it. The problem is there's very few companies in Israel that are that big. So they're going to go to Israel to take a look and see. So where are we in conclusion? Where we are is a place that David Ben-Gurion could never have imagined, but with a downside too, because now that the inner circle has become the outer circle, in the outer circle, especially with particularly Iran, but also possibly Turkey, then the situation has changed. But the thing that nobody ever projected has come to pass, and I will leave you with just one little aspect of this. Who actually helped create the State of Israel in May 1948? We say Harry Truman. Believe it or not, Harry Truman did his best against the opposition of George Marshall and this entire staff, Harry, who said they were going to quit over this. Harry Truman did recognize Israel the same day that they declared independence. But what's powerful here is, where did Israel get its weapons? Not France. No, no. No, no. That started in 56. We haven't heard the right answer yet. Who gave them the fighter planes? Who gave them tanks? Who gave them significant capability? You know the answer. Joseph Stalin. Joseph Stalin did. Not because he had suddenly become a rabid, you know, pro-Semite. He remained very anti-Semitic. We had the black years of Soviet Jewry. We had the 30 Jewish poets who were shot. And we now know, but we're still arguing about it, whether or not he meant to deport all the Jews from Moscow or Leningrad, or maybe only some of them. But he died in January. And he died partly because he made a mistake. Many of the best doctors, you're shocked by this, in Russia were Jews. And because of the anti-Semitism, none of them could help cure him when he lay, you know, inert. And the others, who were not Jewish, were deathly afraid of what would happen to them if he survived, and then punished them for what had happened to him. And so they just left him to die, and they were satisfied. So it's a strange world. It's a world in which two countries that doesn't seem to have almost anything in common are working together on a daily basis. And it's a world in which the biggest decisions still have to be made. What are they going to do about Iran? And that's one that the White House has to decide, and that's one that the Russians have to decide. And if both of them fail, you can be confident of only one thing. The Israelis will strike. They can't afford not to. They've only got three cities worth attacking, and you're not going to attack Jerusalem. So we're down to Tel Aviv and Haifa, and maybe Beersheba, where it's getting. They've got 100, say, 10 years atomic bombs. Nobody in their right mind is going to sit there and wait for them to have those several hundred million, those several hundred atomic bombs. They'll only need to get three or four through, and they could devastate the state. We hope that never happens, absolutely. And in our concluding word, if we have to wish for anything odd, we wish for the Russians to come along, because they could make the difference. Thanks.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Jonathan Adelman, a professor at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver, and author of The Rise of Israel, A History of a Revolutionary State. Dr. Adelman's remarks were given as the 2017 Ruth and Phil Sokoloff Lecture, co-sponsored annually by the Hannah and Natan Schwalb Center for Israel and Jewish Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, and the Jewish Federation of Omaha. He spoke on the topic, Russia and Israel, New Emerging Powers in the Middle East. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, April 27, 2017, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Charlie Reed, Associate Director of Media Relations in the University of Nebraska at Omaha Office of University Communications, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.